So one of the things that was very touching to me were these scientific presentations about altruism and compassion and empathy in children. And one of the researchers was talking about children by the age of 3 with a distinct capacity for noticing when someone was in distress and trying to comfort them. Like if somebody, he talked about these experiments where the researcher would be like tapping a frame onto a picture, something like that. So it was like tap, tap with a hammer. And they'd say tap, 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 tap. And then at one point they'd pretend to hit their finger. And they go, ooh. And the child would respond immediately and do something like bring over their favorite teddy bear, you know, and offer it. Like, oh, here. You know, this will make you feel better, although non-verbally. You know, here, take this. You'll feel better. And so it was so beautiful to get this sense of this nascent, innate quality, which, you know, so sadly can be covered over and hidden and obscured and distorted and so many other things. But to feel that it's there, you know, without the ways that we can be seeking accolades or praise, like, aren't I kind, you know, or, you know, there's not that self-consciousness or sense of trying to do the right thing, even though we hate it, or any of the kinds of ways we can fall into some pattern of behavior, but just that responsiveness, like, ooh, that hurts, you know, here, take this. And so, you know, and for many reasons, that being one of them, it's felt like a very beautiful experience to be hearing all of this and learning from it. And this, of course, is consonant with the Buddhist point of view that compassion, loving kindness, connection are innate to our being. They are certainly covered over and hidden and hard to find and hard to trust. You know, we may not by any means be living in the full flowering of our compassionate potential, but as a potential, it's said to be there and never ever destroyed. One of the routes to unfolding this kind of compassionate potential is wisdom or insight. It's not about trying to manufacture feeling, or certainly not about trying to pretend everything is all right when maybe it's really not all right at all, but it's trying to see as clearly as possible, to see into the nature of things, to understand, for one thing, where happiness comes from. And this is, you know, something the Dalai Lama also has been emphasizing and has emphasized for a long time. I have a book that I just wrote. It's coming out, I think, in October, called The Kindness Handbook, which is like a collection of stories and meditation exercises and things like that having to do with kindness. And I, somewhere very early on, I think I actually originally opened the book with this quotation from the Dalai Lama, but I think the publisher changed that. But somewhere very early on is this quotation from the Dalai Lama where he's talking about selfishness, being selfish. And I took the quote from a time when his English was not nearly as polished as it is right now. So the way he said it was, if you're going to be selfish, then be a wise selfish. You know, meaning that, okay, we do want to be happy. From a certain point of view, you could say that's a selfish urge. But there's a wise way to do that, which is, how are we really going to be happy? You know, if we think it's by endlessly competing and fighting and getting more isolated and cutting off and, you know, having enmity and bearing grudges, and we're wrong, you know? That's just not going to do it. So if we're going to be selfish, which is kind of a given, let's be wise selfish. which means let's figure it out. Let's take a look. Let's be honest. Let's be truthful. Let's not have an agenda, you know, to try to prove something about happiness and suffering and so on. Let's step back and really look at the nature of things. And what we discover, at least this is what the Buddha is positing, is that happiness, true, genuine, more steadfast happiness, may not be found in the ways and in the places we have been led to believe, or that we have kind of cherished as notions, as totems against change. Maybe it's not those things at all. Maybe it's something different. So that's the exploration. I mean, in some ways you could say that's the entire spiritual exploration, is being willing to step back, to have an adventure of consciousness in exploring where is happiness actually to be found. It takes a kind of rigor. It certainly takes that stepping back, which we could say is dispassion. You know, we may have been taught forever and really have incorporated ideas about strength. You know, that to be really strong, you have to be unyielding. You have to be rigid. You can't open. You can't listen. You have to fight. You know, that revenge is really the primary mode of strength. But let's take a look at all of that. You know, not to prove one thing or another, but really to step back and say, well, is that so? Is that how things work? You know, is holding on and clinging and being afraid and, you know, trying to resist change, you know, what's it gotten me thus far? You know, and just pay attention. It's kind of an amazing, even fun sort of thing to do, to look at all of these different habits and ways of being and ways we see ourselves and ways we see the world and so on. It's like being willing to let go of bias, which is one of the definitions of mindfulness. When we are able to see what's happening in our experience without such a strong intrusion of bias, then we have the possibility of discovery. It's like any kind of bias. You know, I used the example in one of the workshops I was teaching of, you know, it's like if you're talking to somebody, you're having a conversation with somebody, and you've already in your mind classified them in some way, like boring or irrelevant to your ambition or whatever it might be. And so the likely scenario in that case is that you're hardly listening. You know, the file's already been put in the filing cabinet. But what happens if we pull that file out? As, you know, we don't have it under W for worthless person anymore. We pull it out. We open it up. We actually listen. There can be some really great surprises along the way. You know, so mindfulness in that sense of letting go of agendas, being open. It's not a cold state, it's not an uncaring state, it's not a callous state or an indifferent state. It's got this beautiful sense of like, well, what is this actually? What is this about? You know, what is the nature of being so afraid, and what does it do, and are there other ways, and, you know, what can this look like? And so one's whole life, in a way, becomes like the creative medium for us. We don't have to dance on ice. We don't have to write movies or plays if that's not our thing. But we live, you know, and that's the manifestation, that's the expression of our creativity. So it's quite wonderful. So if you're going to be selfish, be a wise selfish. What really makes us happy? And it's fantastic, you know, take a look. Mostly, I think what we find are things about connection, not being so isolated, not feeling so cut off. Things about truthfulness, living in harmony with how life actually is. You know, so if we harbor this idea somehow that we will finally be able to hold on successfully to something and keep it from changing, And we try and we try and we try and we try. That's a long road, you know, until we look at like, oh, what does that feel like? Or if we think like, I will actually be able to control somebody else and make their decisions for them and make them happy, for example, or healed or better or whatever. That's another thing to examine. You know, where does that get us and how truthful is that? So we really look at the nature of our experience so that we can understand what being wise, selfish would actually look like. It's like there was an article in the newspaper a few weeks ago. I haven't actually read the article because I was in India when it came out, but I saw the headline, so I emailed it to myself, but I haven't had time to read it yet. But the headline said something like, money does buy happiness when we give it away. So that's why I emailed the article to myself. Because I saw it when I was, you know, like at the business center at the hotel I was staying in India. Things like that, kind of intriguing, you know. So let's really look. And all of that brings me to this idea of compassion, this discussion of compassion. You know, what is the strength in that state? What do we fear is the weakness in that state? What are the consequences of cultivating compassion? What are the benefits? What alarms us about it? You know, what do we think is going to happen? How do we remember or recall people who have been compassionate to us? You know, do we think that the height of foolishness? Do we feel grateful? Do we think, ooh, you know, if they only really knew who I was, then they never would have been that kind. Do we think that we fooled them? You know, I mean, what's going on? As we call to mind somebody who seems to exemplify those aspects, those attributes of compassion. It's quite an interesting journey. So compassion, of course, in the Buddhist tradition, as I'm sure you know, is defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's the movement of one's heart. And as a Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, once said, he said, compassion is a verb. You know, it's the movement of one's heart. It's not like a bad feeling, like, oh, I feel so bad that you're suffering. It's the real movement. And interestingly enough, in the research that is getting more and more prevalent in terms of the brain and the immune system and so on, and meditation, you know, nowadays there's a lot more emphasis on studying compassion meditation, and which, of course, is very similar to loving-kindness meditation. And one of the things that they found is that as people do compassion meditation, two parts of their brains light up. One is the pleasure center, because even though what we are opening to, what we're looking at as we develop compassion is pain or suffering, there's something about that state, because we're connected, because we care. We're not like held back. We're not inhibited. There's something about that state that is actually pleasant, even though it's about opening to suffering. And the other part of the brain that lights up is the motor center. So at first, I guess they thought this was like an artifact, you know, that it was some weird machine problem. But as it got replicated, there began to be a feeling like maybe it's like that quivering, you know, it's like that sense we get, almost like a muscular sense of quivering when we're about to do something, you know, and it's like our being is kind of coming together, it's coordinating, you know, before we launch to do it. So it's like that sense, we want to be there, we want to go forward, we want to see if we can be of help. We may not be able to be of help, which I'll talk about in a minute, but you know, there's something in us that wants to be present, to share, to be connected to the ones that we see that are suffering. And so the that part of the brain is lighting up too. There is that sense in compassion of that verbness, you know, of going forward, but not in the mode of thinking, well, I can fix it. You know, I can make it all better. I'm in charge of the universe after all. You know, that my efforts, my intervention is going to resolve everything, and quickly too. You know, so it's not so much like that. And especially these days, I think of compassion quite a lot in terms of that being with and seeing what emerges. To go back for a moment, one of the things I said in first describing the meditation as we began to practice together, and I talked about balance. It's something kind of along those lines. It's connected for me. Because so much of the idea in Buddhist teaching is not that we're grabbing for an experience, and not that we're trying to, like, you know, get great wisdom like a trophy, you know, so we can go home and tell everybody, oh, look what I got in the retreat. It's not like we're trying to have boundless love as an object, you know, that we can lay claim to. We're not trying to get an experience. We're trying to bring our system into balance, with the idea being that all by itself, out of that balance, great things will emerge. You know, so our work isn't one of craving and clinging and straining and trying to have something we don't have, or holding on to qualities as though they were objects. Our work is to come into greater balance, and all by itself, you know, more love, more compassion, more wisdom, more insight will emerge. So it's a little bit like that sense of just being with in a more balanced way, a more spacious way, that, you know, rather than, say, going into someone's situation with a list of everything they need to do by next week in order not to be suffering anymore, it's just going in and being with and seeing what emerges. It's very different. And so there's some of that sense, I think, to compassion. Because otherwise, what happens is that compassion does get mixed with this effort to be in control and the inevitable disappointment and frustration and distress and sense of failure or blame. Something like that. And so part of this examination is imagining the possibility of having a quality of compassion that isn't so much about doing right away, but is about that kind of connection out of which various activities or efforts or whatever it might be, might arise, might emerge. And to the degree that it is about doing, that it's doing whatever we can to try to make a difference, to make things change, there's an underlying understanding about not being in control that doesn't defeat our efforts, but it actually broadens them. Because then we don't give up so quickly. You know, it's not such a sense of like, uh-oh, you know, you're not getting better fast enough, or, you know, this isn't working, it could never work. But it's really having a very big picture. And this, of course, is the quality that's talked about as equanimity. To be with what is, to see it truthfully, as part of a bigger picture of life. To understand that our efforts to make things better are also infused, it's almost like a sense of mystery. You know, where we want something to happen, we put forth our efforts to see it happen, We have no idea why the 50th time something breaks open, and the 48th it didn't, and the 47th it didn't, and the 49th it didn't, and the 13th it didn't, and you know. And yet, we do what we can do. Not always knowing, and not always having a, you know, kind of an accurate timetable for the unfolding of events. There's a kind of equanimity which is about seeing clearly. It's about wisdom. It's about insight. To say, yeah, things are as they are. I will do everything I can do to try to make a difference. And isn't it the case that I'm not in control of the unfolding of events? It's like friends of mine who are parents tell me that when they have more than one child, they say, it's amazing. It's like they come in as such distinct little beings, you know, that there seems to be a kind of path, one could say, you know, that at least at one's beginning, you know, so that there's just a different unfolding. We can't mold them to be exactly, you know, who we think they should be. And so it's very much kind of in that spirit that we practice the sense of compassion. So what broadens our understanding? It is wisdom. It's insight. It's seeing what we can do and what we can't do. It's seeing what we can't control. It's remembering change. It's remembering that everything's born out of conditions. It arises and passes away. It's remembering the nature of life itself as being pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. Just like in any 45-minute period of sitting, there's like pleasure and pain and pleasure and pain and pleasure and pain, constantly changing. I think sometimes of all the countless meditation periods I've had, you know, say an hour, where at the end of the hour I've looked back and said to myself, okay, was that a good one or a bad one? Which is a really stupid question, because on what basis, after all, are we calling it good or bad? But even apart from that, it hadn't just been one thing. You know, there were moments of peace and moments of sleepiness and moments of distress and moments of joy and moments of sadness and moments of real clarity, moments of confusion. That was that 45-minute period. That was that hour-long period. And isn't it always that way? But, you know, looking back, we tend to kind of lump it together as though it were just one thing, usually the worst thing. But it's not. It's constantly moving. It's constantly changing. That's how things are. I talked earlier today about sympathetic joy, that ability to rejoice in the happiness of others. And I said, you know, one of the things that really challenges us in the development of sympathetic joy is falling into the trap of forgetting impermanence. You know, when we're jealous of somebody or envious of somebody, we don't remember that life is pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. We think, I have nothing and will never have anything. And they have everything, and they always, always, always will. Isn't that the sneaky kind of foundation for that sense of, you know, being so overcome by jealousy? So we look at these ideas that, you know, that we have and that we hold, and we look at their consequences. And when we break free of them, then there is this kind of openness, the sense of balance, the sense of equanimity. And we then use it to support qualities like love and compassion and sympathetic joy. Because after all, you know, if we're opening to pain and suffering and seeking to develop a compassionate relationship to that pain or suffering, don't we need a kind of balance? after all? You know, I not too long ago, I ran into a friend somewhere. You know, sort of like a conference, kind of like this one. And something that was presented in one of the lectures was, it brought up a kind of distressing sense for her. You know, it was just like, ooh, that's hard to bear, that's hard to look at. And when I ran into her, it was in the lobby of the hotel where this thing was going on. And I said, hi, where are you going? She said, I'm leaving. And I said, why? And she said, that was, you know, I don't want to go there. You know, and I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, sometimes it's right to leave. Sometimes, you know, we don't want to go there. But sometimes when we don't want to go there, it's just this kind of reflex of like, that's unpleasant. I don't want my path, you know, to include anything that is unpleasant. But how realistic is that? You know, I mean, we all know what happens. It's like you get on the airplane, you know, fleeing the conference, and the airplane's stuck in the tarmac for 6.5 hours or something like that, you know, and it's like, those things don't usually work that well, you know. You end up in a spiral of avoidance, and like everywhere you look, there's some unpleasant thing that you're trying to run from. And so there's pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. That's like the backdrop for our understanding. Sometimes we get what we want and sometimes we don't. Sometimes somebody, it's almost like I think sometimes that it's like healing has its own rhythm. You know, sometimes situations or institutions or families or people, individuals, you know, things will evolve and it's in a time frame it's okay, and sometimes it's not. You know, sometimes we are just planting seeds and doing the best that we can and needing to let go of having to be in control and having immediate results. So it's an arising and passing away. We see it in an hour of sitting. We see it in a day. You know, we see it in a month, all of the time. I told a story this afternoon also about I was volunteering for the campaign of one of the presidential candidates, whose name I will not mention, lest it becomes an issue, since we may not share that advocacy. But anyway, I was in New York City, and one of the things I did was my friends and I one day were assigned to stand in this park, which is called Union Square, with the name of the candidate on these signs, right? So the place we were standing was right in front of the subway station. So people were coming out of the subway, and the first thing they would see was, you know, this group of us holding these signs with this candidate's name on it. So the first person who came out of the subway caught sight of me, came right up to me and said to me, "You suck." And I thought, that's intense, you know. Like, it's not even the candidate they're talking about. They're talking about me, you know. And then I just stood there, you know, and then the next person, I teach, quite often I teach series of classes in New York City. So the next person who came out of the subway happened to have been to a number of my classes. And she came up to me and she said, "I adore you." And I thought, oh, you I like, you know, like, why don't you stand here for a while, which she did. And I thought it was a perfect microcosm, you know, of a day. Or a month. And isn't it, you know, things just arise and pass away. Sometimes we like them, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we get a lot of praise. Sometimes somebody really doesn't like what we're standing for, you know? It's just like, it's this vast web of conditions coming together and coming apart. So if we work on that, you know, having greater balance, greater equanimity, you can sense how that affects our ability to be present for someone. Our depth of compassion or connection that isn't no longer about us, you know, but is really about being there, present. We can sense how that trembling or the quivering of the heart can actually be more sustainable. You know, we're not so overwhelmed, we're not so overcome by the disquietude and the unhappiness or the suffering we may face. Not that it's easy, you know, I don't want to be glib about it. It's very, very, very difficult. But it's made more difficult by that other thing that we do, feeling that I'm in charge. You know, I've got to make it all better. Or anything I do is fruitless. It's not enough. It could never be enough. If we have some balance, then there is a greater ability to be with some very grave, difficult situations in a more sustained and a more compassionate way. It's like when I was in India, as I said, you know, a few weeks ago, taking some teachings from the Dalai Lama, and it was just as this is an amazing time to be with him, given everything that's going on in Tibet. You know, that was even closer in time, and it was quite strong. It was, you know, I kept thinking, I hadn't been to India in 12 years, so it's not like I go all the time, you know, and I went for this specific opportunity to take these teachings with him. And when I heard what happened in Tibet, I wondered very strongly if they were going to be canceled, those teachings were going to be canceled, because I thought, okay, worst case scenario is they're canceled and I'm on the plane already, you know. But that's not what happened. And even being there, you know, I kept thinking, well, he's in Delhi, it's the seat of the government, you know, maybe he needs to... And he did end up making some adjustments, but I was amazed. It was like every day, there he was, you know, completely present, answering questions. And of course, it would come up quite a bit. He said in the beginning, there were two sets of teachings, one primarily for Indian people, one primarily for Western people. And at the beginning of each time, you know, each series, he said the same thing. He said, my head is filled with disturbing thoughts, but my heart is very steady. And in the Newsweek interview that had been done with him, it said that he was practicing Tonglen, you know, that Tibetan practice where you like breathe in the distress and anxiety and anger and suffering of others, and you breathe out like the good things, you know, like virtue and calm and love and compassion and so on. And so he was doing that for the Chinese soldiers and government officials, you know, he was breathing in that suffering and breathing out that which he could give. And even though I'm sure it is very, very hard, it's really a tragedy and very traumatic, I often think of him just like breathing it in, you know, and breathing it out. And always when, you know, something so intense is going on for somebody, I'm very impressed by their ability to care and to be with others. You know, sometimes somebody would get up in the context of these teachings and ask a question that was, usually it was preceded by something like, Your Holiness, I have a very simple question for you, and then it would be this long, you know, complicated, philosophical question. And you know, it wasn't like he said, you know, you think you've got a problem, you know, like, I've got a country that's being devastated. You know, being who he is, he didn't like diminish anybody or make them feel like their question was unimportant or, you know, they should hurry up because he had to go back and do something more important or their suffering didn't count. There was nothing like that. You know, just totally present with everybody and very, very patient. And it was quite impressive, you know, that he could reach out or he could be there even with this really horrible situation going on. And so it's a tremendous model, I think, for all of us in what we actually are capable of, you know, what we can do. So do you have any simple questions for me? Or anything you'd like to talk about? Anything you'd like to share? Yeah.
I was a psychotherapist for 40 years. And I think of that, not that I got to heal, but that process is healing. Mm-hmm. And I get to facilitate or open doors, open doors, or put some air into the room that could make that more likely, perhaps. Okay.
Yeah, that's okay. The comment was about when I said something about Well, you might go back. The comment was about when I said something about one of the ways that we might try to control someone else is through this thought that we can heal them and maybe be frustrated because it's not happening fast enough. Something like that, and so our comment is about having been a psychotherapist for many years and not having the feeling that she was healing somebody, but that she was somehow facilitating the process. And was that okay? You know, and certainly, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, but we can feel the difference inside of us. You know, when, in some ways, that's like what I was saying before. I don't mean to imply that being there in a situation is the same as being passive or ineffectual, but it's different than when we think we are the ones that have to make it better and that we then feel, first of all, we're discounting someone else's unfolding and the rhythm, as I said, of their healing. And we're also probably discounting those small steps, you know, those little things, with this kind of feeling like I am the agent of transformation for you. And I need to somehow impart something to you. You know, so it's really, I think you're saying exactly the same thing, actually. Was there another hand? Good. That's why I like coming to Seattle. It's like it's such an enlightened city. What was the question? Was it? Yeah, I'm taking a second. Somebody, was it yesterday? It was last night. Somebody said, asked me a question about Seattle being an over-caffeinated city and New York City being a sleepless city. It was an exotic kind of question. Yeah, somebody there.
Yeah. I have a question. Sometimes I find when I open myself to the pain of others, whether it be, you know, a one-on-one situation or a bigger situation, that it gets stuck. I find myself carrying it for days and weeks. Do you have any suggestions for how to keep that from happening?
I'll repeat your question, even though you said it in such a nice loud voice for the tape. The question was about opening oneself to the pain or suffering of somebody or others, whether one-on-one or in a group situation. Somehow, sometimes that feeling of that pain being stuck within and carrying it even for weeks and don't have any suggestions. And you know, I think sometimes that's just going to happen as we are open, as we're as we pay attention, as we realize that this is like resonating with us, you know, in some way. But there's also there are also times when that happens because, you know, it's almost like something unresolved in us also getting triggered. Or it happens because we, we do have this feeling. It's almost like guilt. You know, we've taken it in because we couldn't make it better. And, you know, and we hold on to it in some way. You know, and that's what I was really just talking about before, you know, like, well, the other side of that feeling, like we are responsible for the unfolding of the universe, is the distress when it doesn't work out that way, you know, and then we hold it. So I think it's really something only, you know, you yourself can feel the difference between those two, you know, when it's a kind of more natural, inevitable sensitivity or poignancy. And when it really is almost that kind of guilt, you know, or that feeling like I didn't make it go away and I'm going to hold it, you know, I'm going to keep it and confront that sad truth again and again and again. And it's, you know, in the terms of the Buddhist psychology, it's really about the evolution of the quality of equanimity. You know, it's not just getting a little more space, it's really getting a lot more space from wisdom, from understanding that things arise due to causes and conditions. We can't always change them all for somebody. You know, we do what we can, and yet, you know, there is so much, and that that doesn't negate what we can do, and we keep doing what we can do, and yet, you know, it's a big, big, big picture that we really need to come to terms with the truth of what happens, you know, in this world. And I think one of the great measures for us is the sense of whether facing our own or someone else's suffering makes us feel more isolated or more connected. You know, and that would be a good kind of measure. Yeah.
What happened in Thailand had three of us foreign monks who got attached to a dog, and the temple dogs over there are pretty mangy and young. This guy, he had us contemplate it. And our daily meditation go out, we laid it out in a field, and had us go out there each day to find the balance, to smell the rotting, to find the balance of what, you know, one of the things, the absolute truth, death is happening. But he had to give us a sense of equanimity. How little our ideas about that really matter.
Yeah, yeah. So the comment was about in Thailand, growing very fond of a temple dog and then having the dog die, and the abbot of the monastery instructing this group of people to go out and observe, you know, the decaying process of the dog having died and come to terms with that and have a kind of balance of equanimity. Definitely, you know, like in the tradition, there are many ways and many the many ways balance is talked about, the many methods that are used to achieve balance. Sometimes it's just clear seeing, you know, it's just being mindful. And more mindful that brings us to a state of balance. Sometimes, and this is very classic, you know, methods are used to try to almost like serve like an antidote, you know, or bring in an opposite energy to the energy that's already there. to achieve a greater kind of balance. And so this is very, very classic. Like if you look at very old, you know, Buddhist texts, for example, commentaries, they would talk about, say, if you're a very angry or fearful person, then your teacher would usually direct you to do loving kindness practice because it would bring in the opposite sort of tendency. If you were full of desire, you know, or greed or lust, then often there would be a meditation on death and decay, and it might be with a corpse or it might be just a reflection on impermanence and, you know, bring in the opposite energy to kind of make something whole in that way. And of course, most people would rather, and they say, well, I think I'm angrier than I am greedy, so I think I'll just do some loving kindness practice, you know, as a balance. I don't really think I want to do that other. You know, and it's very hard in our society to understand those practices. There are many in classical Buddhist teaching, and they're very hard to understand, you know, because it seems like it wouldn't bring us to a place of balance, that it would bring us to, you know, something very distressing, like disgust or whatever it might be. But they're really done for the purpose of bringing us to a kind of balance. And so, and actually I think certainly if we look at this society, we're so out of balance, you know, that it would probably take a lot, you know, to come to a state of more clarity and truthfulness about the nature of the body and impermanence and so on. A friend of mine once said, when many years ago, Bill Moyers had that quite wonderful TV series on about death and dying, and the series was titled in a way that was totally appropriate to the actual content, but also had a funny connotation out of context. The content, of course, was about, you know, hospitals and the medical profession and the ways in which the process of dying had in some way been taken over. And so the series was called something like Dying on Our Own Terms. And my friend came up with the rather amused contemplation that dying is often the one thing we don't do on our own terms, you know? It's like, because if we did 90, I don't know, something percent of the time, we wouldn't do it, you know? But, you know, here too, you know, it's like we think, well, yeah, you know, I'm going to master that.
I have a question. A couple of years ago, I don't remember what it was, around the tsunami hit Thailand, a bunch of friends, I remember all of us saying a bunch of things that happened, saying, felt like we had compassion fatigue, that so many things were happening, and I sometimes feel that now, and other people with the war and everything that's going on, and I often wonder if it's me sort of feeling helpless and overwhelmed and shutting down that way, or if there really is a thing such as compassion fatigue, you just have nothing left at some point.
The question was about compassion fatigue and whether it's like a personal thing where one feels like helpless and overcome and shuts down from that, or whether it's really like a condition, you know, where you can have nothing left to give. And I think it could be either, actually. I don't think of it as compassion fatigue, but it's like I think the clinical term for it is vicarious traumatization. You know, one of the things I do is I'm part of a project at, from this other center in the East Coast in New York State, working with domestic violence shelter workers, bringing the tools of yoga and meditation and, you know, daily being exposed to some very traumatic material definitely has a kind of effect. You know, but it's not just exhaustion. It's not just being burnt out. It's not just needing to renew. It's something else, you know, where some very foundational parts of life are shaken, like one's sense of meaning, you know, and the feeling that, you know, maybe no matter what you do, but I don't mean just a passing feeling, but a very deep sense of, you know, no matter what you do, it could never make a difference. Things like that, you know, I mean, that's a whole other thing than I think the state that, well, maybe you could see as a, be seen as a kind of spectrum, but I think it's different, you know, even if it's just a difference of degree from what we get into, I think all of us, when we're, it's just too much, you know, I cannot stand to pay attention one more time, because then it's mostly a question of renewal, you know, it's like some kind of balance that's needed. And somebody once told me, of somebody going through an MBSR program, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and it was somebody who, one of the sources of stress in his life was that he was very busy and he didn't have enough time for his children and for his partner, and, you know, there was a lot of pressure and things going on, and then in the examination of his day, this guy's day, he disclosed that he, like, watched 3 news shows and read 4 newspapers or something like that. This was a long time ago, you know, before the internet. He something like that. He watched 3 news shows and read 4 newspapers. And the instructor, who was the person telling me the story, told me that they'd said to him, maybe try cutting back, you know, like 1 newspaper, 1 news show a week, you know, something like that. There are ways, and obviously, you know, we need to really understand, you know, what we're bringing in and where our own edges are and where we need to find a better balance. And also to realize that, you know, we may have priorities and those priorities may shift and those priorities have to include ourselves and things like that. But I think there's another problem, or that other problem that we get into is really a kind of desolation, you know, which is different, where we have such a hard time feeling that what we do is in any way making a difference, you know, because there's just so much out there. And, you know, that I think is a different kind of challenge, and is something where we really have to grapple with a sense of meaning and you know, what is it that is our purpose, and, you know, are we fulfilling it, and what are we connecting to, and so on. Like I was, when I was working on this book, this next book, I met a friend for lunch in New York, and she said, tell me something that's in the book. And so I told her this story, this lovely story of generosity and somebody feeling like tremendous fulfillment from their generosity. And she was looking at me like, yeah, all right, you know. And I said, okay, what, you know? And she said, I don't think that's a very interesting book. She said, I want to hear stories where kindness really costs something, you know, where you weren't filled with like this flood of happiness and fulfillment, you know, that you were able to give something. You know, I wanna hear stories where it was really rough and the satisfaction didn't come like by the afternoon, you know, like, oh, I'm filled with delight, I gave something, you know. And I took her challenge to heart. I thought, you know, she's right. There's a reason why so many of those books are like really saccharine, you know. I thought, she's right. Because sometimes it's very hard. And still we have to be able to connect to what we really care about, you know, what we think is right and where we think happiness is going to be found truly, genuinely, and so on. So you can all look at the book and tell me if I did okay or not. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm better at compassion for others than for self. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I'm assuming I'm not alone, and I'm wondering, as I get aspirations and expectations, I know are not the right words for a spiritual journey, but I develop them and ideals about how it's going to go, I get so let down by my attempts and my defeats at some point. I was just curious if you had any words of help around the hopelessness or the feeling of rejection, wanting to jump off the path, even though there's no escape.
So the question was about having an easier time having compassion for others than compassion for oneself, which is, just as you say, it's not an unusual problem. And in terms of the connection of that to aspiration and expectation, I think in some ways that our aspirations tend to be too small. It's not that they're too big, it's that they're too small, you know, like, and they're too specific in a way, perhaps, and also certainly too bound up in time. You know, like, if you have an aspiration to never get angry again, unlikely. You know, really. But you can have an aspiration to be free, which might mean, at least for now, not being as lost in anger. Or the way we usually describe it is that we cannot control what will arise in our minds, but over time we can relate differently to what arises in our minds. So your target might be off, you know, and part of relating differently is that we may be filled with a state like anger, and then add on top of that all kinds of things, like, I'm such an angry person and I always will be, or this is never going to change, or this means I will never, you know, whatever it might be. So one of the things we always say in, like, meditation lingo is look for the add-ons. You know, what are we adding on to this situation? And begin to release those, you know, let go of those. And then the anger comes, but it's not the same thing as it once was. It may be that it used to last a day, now it's lasting an hour, because we're not busy adding on all these things. We're not creating a whole sense of who we are around that feeling of anger. We're seeing more clearly into it, we're seeing the layers that are a part of it. It's a different world, even though it still came. Maybe we have more compassion for ourselves with the arising of anger, rather than judgment, rather than blame. Then the next time someone else is angry, maybe we have a little more compassion for them, you know? And so there's a whole universe of learning and growing and changing that does not match, I shouldn't have gotten angry again. You know, something else is going on. And so I think the aspiration needs to be really big. Like, I want to be a free person. You know, and there will be lots of angles on that all along the way. And none of it will ever have anything to do with being able to control what arises in our experience. It's like trying to control the weather here in Seattle. Really. Because everything that arises, arises due to conditions coming together. Immediate conditions, old conditions, you know, new conditions, all kinds of things coming together. It's like every one of you came in here having gotten here in some way, right? So what if you were stuck in traffic? That makes a difference to your mood when you walk in here, you know, and sit down to meditate. Or you were almost in a car accident, or the bus was late, or, you know, so many things. So you can't imagine that tonight's meditation is going to look exactly like this morning's meditation, or that it will be a sequence. Well, I had 5 minutes of bliss this morning, so I should have 10 minutes of bliss tonight. You know, it's not like that. It's not that linear. Because what about all that happened during the day? And what about, you know, the phone call that we got and the memory that we had and the, you know, and the transportation drama that, you know, might have brought us here or whatever it might be. Or maybe you got the best parking place in the universe, you know, right in front of the building or behind the building or something like that. And you came in all filled with delight. What does that mean about tomorrow morning sitting, you know, if you don't get enough sleep? This progression, this nice progression. Everything comes together as conditions coming together and coming apart. We will never be able to fully control that. But what we can do is learn all those skills of mindfulness, mindful awareness, and compassion, and loving kindness, and so on, to greet what is happening in a different way, in a really transformed way. Otherwise, sort of reminds me of one of my Tibetan teachers, Sokhna Rinpoche, who has a great way of mimicking us. You know, I've often thought he should have been an actor because he's a tremendous mimic. He's amazing. And so he's describing like a prototypical meditator in a city. You know, who says, well, you know, I can't meditate in my living room because it's too noisy. I think I'll build a shrine in my closet. You know, and so they kind of create this amazing scene in the closet and sit down to meditate. And they hear the sounds of the plumbing and, you know, the pipes, the water in the pipes. So that's very distressing. So then they go out and they get those kind of earphones that people wear in airport tarmacs, and they're like sitting there afraid of a sound, you know. But as they prepare, like they, you know, they like smooth out everything on the cushion, you know, so like nothing's folded, nothing's rubbing, nothing's irritating, and maybe they're burning some incense. It's very sweet and nice, you know. Everything, you know, is just so fantastic. And you sit down and you're all composed, and then you have a thought. You know? And it's all over, because that's the one thing we can't, like, you know, determine, like, what's going to happen. It's just the way it is. But it's okay. You know, there's such a difference between having a difficult state arise and taking it to heart and saying, that's who I really am and that's who I'm always going to be, you know, on the one side, and on the other side, having a difficult state arise and being able to say, yeah, that's what it is. It's changing. You know, having some kindness toward ourselves is different. So it's right there. You can develop the compassion for yourself.
Mm-hmm. In sense of meaning?
In that particular context, I would use the idea of a sense of meaning around, well, something like aspiration and fulfillment of goal and so on. So if I was in a situation where there seemed to be a kind of futility around changing the situation. You know, maybe somebody's suffering and I can't seem to make a difference in the actual circumstance or their mental state or whatever it might be. I would find this sense of, you could say, coherence or integrity, which is a sense of meaning, more about how I was in that situation, you know, the degree of loving kindness or compassion or presence that would have that sense of, I guess, meaningfulness, you know, or integrity is another way of saying it, you know, rather than the end result, which may or may not be that satisfying in the timetable that I have decreed, you know, it should all be worked out with him. You know, so something like that. Mm-hmm. Either one.
Someone back here asked me to ask a question for her.
Okay.
She wanted to know what your compassion meditation experience was like, or what the meditation was.
Uh-huh. Okay, so compassion meditation is kind of a companion to loving kindness meditation. And it could be, the quality of compassion could be developed through doing loving kindness meditation, or it could be developed as a meditation on its own. Both practices are the silent repetition of certain phrases offered. The phrases are the expressions of the heart, so they are the way we pay attention to ourselves or to someone else. It's the way we channel our energy toward ourselves or someone else. The phrases are offered to ourselves and to others. And that's the nature of the meditation. So rather than gathering our attention around the feeling of the breath the way we did, we gather our attention around the repetition of these phrases. And it's very similar kind of skill. You know, it's like you're there, you say a phrase or two, you find out you're a million miles away, you know, your mind has gone off somewhere. You just gently let go and bring it back and begin again. So the loving kindness phrases are usually three or four in number. And we begin with ourselves and end with the extension of loving kindness to all beings everywhere. And what we do in the middle of those two can be different at different times. There is a classical progression, which I talk about in the first book that I wrote called Loving Kindness. And it's a progression from offering loving kindness to ourselves and then to someone known as a benefactor, someone who's helped us, and then a friend, a neutral person, somebody we don't particularly like or dislike, someone we have some difficulty with, and then all beings, you know, all of life. And so, but there's a lot of creativity and flexibility that's possible within it. The basic bookends are starting with oneself and ending with all beings. And, you know, it's not really imagined, like if you're sitting at home for 20 minutes, that you're going to get to do all those categories, but you might start with yourself, and then there might be somebody you're feeling particularly grateful to, or you're very worried about, or, you know, there's something compelling about someone that has you put them in your loving kindness meditation, and then ending with that extension of loving kindness to all beings. So that's basically it. It's a wonderful practice, you know, it's its own kind of practice. Okay, maybe on that note, we'll end.